riding on the horse with Pat, driving about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind him switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. You're walking on the fighting side of me. Running down just how long the rest of us can count on being free. They love our milk and honey, but they preach about some other way of living. When they're running down our country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Yeah, walking on the fighting side of me. Running down
Yes, when you're running down my country, you're walking down the fighting side of me. And that's the name of this program here on altrighttv.com. had a good meeting in the next stop on my tour tonight. I was in Edmonton, Alberta. Great meeting of some fine patriots, including, of course, one of the victims of Canada's notorious anti-free speech laws. Preacher Bill Watcott and his fine wife Yadranka, and he gave us a bit of an update on his case as well. My topic tonight was Canada is cancel culture central. All the people at the meeting explained to me what he'd learned from a contact of his in Surrey, British Columbia, and this contact told him about a local truck company owner who's a Sikh, and one of the problems is that the Sikhs are making a major effort to take over much of the trucking industry across Canada, but particularly in Western Canada, and their business tactics often are very, very shoddy. For instance, they will very often employ only fellow Sikhs, sometimes involved in scams to get them status in Canada. For instance, to provide them with an employment history. They come here and develops an employment history to further an immigration claim. therefore, they often work for very, very little. Provides unfair competition with legitimate, usually white-owned businesses who follow a very complicated and very stringent rules about driver safety and training. And there have been cases where Sikh drivers hired from within the community, often newcomers, are given hardly any training, and this was not surprising that 2 years ago in Humboldt, Saskatchewan, a Sikh driver who had only about a month's experience rammed an 18-wheeler into a bus carrying the town's hockey team with catastrophic results. I think 16 killed and 18 injured, some of them permanently crippled, and so on. Anyway, my informant tells me that this one particular Sikh trunk company owner ran 50 trucks and boasted that he would take employment applications from anybody. And if the employment application was from a white fellow, after a nice smile or two, it would simply float into the garbage. And as he hired staff, he would first of all hire staff from his family in India, his near family, then his distant relations, and then friends. And he would always bring these people over, he'd fly them over, and he was skilled at playing the temporary foreign workers scam. And the theory is this: Canadian businesses can apply to hire a temporary foreign worker if they've advertised and not been able to find any takers. Well, he fakes ads, or he puts them in such obscure publications that he's not likely to get any response. Now, this is not his example, but it'd be my example. If I really want just to fudge the system, I would put an ad for a truck driver in, let's say, a Canadian Stamp Collectors monthly magazine. Well, then there probably aren't too many stamp collectors who are also truck drivers looking for work, you know. So you go through the reason, the motions, and then you say, oh, sorry, I tried my best, couldn't find any truck drivers, so I want to hire so-and-so from India, who just happens to turn out to be my cousin. Often these people are paid the minimum wage for a truck driving job, rising from about, depending on the minimum wage, $14 or $15 an hour to a maximum of $20. Well, they're just starting out, and they're glad to get it. Also, very often the maintenance of these trucks is incredibly shoddy. So, cutting on the on the labor costs, cutting on complying with the maintenance and safety, these Sikh run companies can often outbid legitimate European owned companies in Canada that who follow the rules. Now, you say, or you know, we ask, well, whose fault is this? Well, it's partly the fault of corrupt, gutless government. You know, these regulations are enforced by ministries of transportation and so on. This is just not enforced that much against, you know, non-whites, because, well, you know what they'd say? Well, you can guess what they'd say. It's racism. You're just picking on us because we wear turbans. If we were a healthy society, that would be simply laughed off. No, we're investigating you because we think you're not following the rules. And if you're not following the rules, you will be punished the same as anybody else. But that's not the way things are done. So I found this a very interesting insight. Now, a couple of days ago, and that was on the 10th of this month, there was an opinion piece in the National Post, and it appeared on the 10th, and it was an opinion piece by Bernie Farber and Len Rudner. Now, they were a tag team at the old Canadian Jewish Congress. Bernie Farber was the chief executive officer of the old Canadian Jewish Congress for a good number of years, and Len Rudner was a close assistant and associate. Canadian Jewish Congress kind of morphed into something else. That was the Center for Israel and Jewish Affairs. And Bernie Farber did not go with it, but he's still quite the activist. He's with the Canadian Anti-Hate Network in Ottawa. And let's be quite clear, it has nothing to do with anti-hate. It's anti-white and anti-German. Well, they penned this opinion piece. And, dates are important.
this book appeared on the 10th, and the 10th is the beginning of the Jewish feast of Purim. Now, I mentioned this a couple of nights ago. Purim is a sadistic feast commemorating the massacre of Persians who had been seen to be hostile to Jews who were then in the court of the Persian king. And in Purim, on the face of Purim, Jews bake a sort of cookie or confection in the form of an ear. This is Haman's ear. Well, this is a feast commemorating the massacre of Gentiles. Hooray! Wonderful! Well, this following column appeared on that day. And I don't think it's coincidental. The National Post has a very significant Jewish influence. I believe they agreed to run it on Purim. I mean, was it just numerous days? They published 6 days a week. I'm sorry, 5 days a week. Tuesday through Saturday, of the days that they could have published, why was it on that day? And this is not time sensitive. You know, it's not like a comment on a story that occurred the day before. This is a general sort of article. Well, what does this article want? Well, this is, they want one more Gentile victim. Opinion: enough with legal gymnastics. It's time for Helmut Oberlander to go. I'm going to read parts of this. Almost 20 years ago, the Federal Court of Canada, Judge Andrew McKay, delivered his decision on the legal status of Helmut Oberlander. His findings were clear. Oberlander had been a member of a National Socialist Mobile Killing Unit, EK-10A, for a period of 18 months or more between 1941 and 1942. He'd served as an interpreter in a unit whose role was to murder civilians. Well, I don't think... that's a fair description. I don't think its purpose was to murder civilians. Hitler, the German army, didn't say, go and murder some civilians. Is that actually very helpful? don't forget the German armies in 1941 attacked the Soviet Union, which was about to attack them. It would not be particularly helpful to go in and start killing civilians, because many of the civilians welcomed the German armies after having suffered over 20 years of communist repression. Anyway, important facts. And the judge believed he had misrepresented or failed to disclose his wartime activities when he arrived in Canada and later received Canadian citizenship. In his ruling, McKay argued that had Oberlander been truthful, he never would have been admitted to Canada and would not have been granted citizenship. Okay, a couple very important points here. Helmut Oberlander was a Volksdeutsch, that is, a German community living in what was then the Ukraine. He spoke Ukrainian, Russian, and German. And when the German armies came in, they took 17-year-old Helmut and said, we need you as an interpreter. And that was his role. He was not a soldier. He made no decisions about what this unit did or didn't do. Okay. 17 or 18 years of age. Well, in the relevant time, he was 17 and 18. In Canada, no matter what he'd done when he was 17, Helmut Oberlander would be considered a young offender. And even if it had been murdered, if he'd committed murder, he would have gotten no more than a 10-year sentence. But Helmut Oberlander didn't. This has always struck me to be very, very relevant, that whatever Oberlander did, and nobody suggests he ever did anything other than act as an interpreter, all of that should have been long ago dismissed as something he did as a youth. Okay, now the judge concluded that he must have not told the truth, or not must have lied or not told the truth. On the basis that had he mentioned he'd been in this unit, he would not have been granted citizenship. Superficially, that may make some sense. There's a problem, though. Helmut Oberlander was interviewed after the end of the Second World War, and many other people came forth and said that they were not asked what their wartime service was. In fact, if you had come from what was being part of the Soviet Union, what the RCMP was interested in was, had you been a member of the Communist Party? That was their interest. Now, how can a man who didn't speak much English be expected to volunteer information he's not being asked? Now, you might say, well, wouldn't the records of the time, of the interviews be around them? That could quickly be ascertained. Well, not really, because when the German bashing campaign against Helmut Oberlander began over 20 years ago, these files from the late 40s had long since been destroyed. So there was no evidence. Now, the judge chose to make an inference. Now, this case has been immensely complicated. It has been back and forth, up and down to the courts a number of times. And finally, when the Supreme Court late last year declined to hear an appeal, most of the legal avenues for Helmut Oberlander had been exhausted. Now, he's 95 years old, in feeble health, and you might say, well, okay, Canada takes a chance on many immigrants, many so-called refugees. Oh, it's also interesting to know that the RCMP says about 90% of refugees lie. Yeah, that's right, they lie. In fact, made-up stories or half-truths or no truths at all are common. So refugees lie, and that's not in and of itself fatal to their applications. Yeah, that's right. We take in liars all the time. So what should be different about Oberlander? And we take a chance on them. Well, okay, we took a chance on Helmut Oberlander over 60 years ago. Well, how did that turn out? Well, that turned out really well. Helmut Oberlander was a strong contributing citizen in the Kitchener-Waterloo area. He went into construction. He was a big builder, built a lot of the suburbs in and around Kitchener, Ontario. He was a contributor, a big taxpayer, employer, all the good stuff, ideal immigrant. So why? Why would we be going after him? Or why should the Canadian government be going after him? After a lifetime of contribution. Well, there's one reason, and one reason only, and that is the endless pressuring of the Never Again Jewish lobby, the former Canadian Jewish Congress, the League for Human Rights of B'nai B'rith, now the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, the Jewish lobby, although the Canadian Anti-Hate Network is not exclusively Jewish, the Jewish lobby has pressured the government for years to move on Helmut Oberlander and to strip him of his citizenship, which has been done, and to deport him, which has not yet been done. This is nothing more than the spirit of Purim, of the destruction of a Gentile. And in this case, it's shameless German bashing. If Helmut Oberlander had been a Sikh and had killed Hindus, or was alleged to have been involved in a unit that killed Hindus, there'd be no problem. And unfortunately, the Canadian political establishment is so cowardly and so subject to the pressures and influence of the Jewish lobby that the Jewish lobby has been able to get its way in tormenting a contributing citizen and a feeble 95-year-old German for no other reason than that he fought on the wrong side in World War II. There's no evidence, and there never has been a claim, that he ever committed a crime personally, that he ever shot a prisoner, that he ever abused somebody. He just happened to be in this unit, and which, and I make no comment on the allegations, because a lot of the allegations by the Jewish lobby are over the top, but even if the unit itself did some rough things, Helmut Oberlander was a kid, and he was a translator. And so the Farber, the Bernie Farber, Len Rudner article continues. I won't go over all the twists and turns, but now with all avenues seemingly closed, Oberlander's lawyers have unveiled a new argument, a new legal argument. In essence, they claim that Judge McKay was entitled to make a finding only as to whether or not Oberlander misled authorities in order to gain entry into Canada and later receive citizenship. Everything beyond that was merely opinion on the part of the judge and therefore no force or effect. They further argue that even if their client was properly stripped of citizenship, he retains domicile and therefore cannot be deported. Domicile is an old Roman legal concept that predates the government involvement in immigration. It refers to a fixed place of residence. It meant, more or less, one's primary place of residence, or the place from which that person has the strongest factual connection. And yes, for Helmut Oberlander, his domicile has been Canada for for over 60 years. And he's been a contributing citizen. I think this is a good argument on the part of Helmut Oberlander's lawyers. I would think an even more powerful argument is, look, this has gone on long enough. The World War II has been over for 75 years. When do you draw the line and say enough is enough? Now, the Never Again Vengeance Lobby, the German bashers of the various Jewish lobby groups, of course, will never stop. As long as there's one German who served in the German armed forces in World War II still alive. This is where Canadian decency should come in and say, enough is enough. Let him live out the remaining few months or year of his life in Canada, in his domicile. Where is he to be deported? He's no longer a German citizen. He was born and brought up in what is now the Ukraine. That's a different government and so on. Is he to be deported to Kiev? This is where real leadership should come in. And this is why I've been urging members of German organizations to speak up, and they have to some extent in the past, but speak up and put it to the politicians. You'll have us to answer for if you do this. And, you know, I think it has to go to be on an emotional basis. This is German bashing. Now, a lawyer may be turned on by some of the legal niceties here, but on an emotional level, this is German bashing. It's trying to torment an old man who is a contributing Canadian citizen for no other reason than he translated as a teenager for a unit that's accused of having done some rough things, and that he did not tell immigration authorities that. But we have no proof that he didn't tell them. Well, no, maybe I should put it differently. We have no proof that they ever asked. Now, you're always told by a lawyer, and street smarts tell you this as well, don't answer questions you weren't asked. Don't volunteer information with officialdom, particularly if it might be hostile officialdom, because many a person has babbled their way deeper into trouble. So answer only what you are asked. Here is I caught this, you know, when it was first reported. And I thought, oh, no, it's got to be wrong. Apparently it's not wrong, though. This is called when it doesn't add up. Math is hard, and at least for some liberal journalists, it's a column by John Robson. Remember Dr. Evil demanding $1 million and getting blank stares? Satire can't keep up with reality. Two highly paid analysts with MSNBC and the New York Times, so these are, in terms of the lamestream media, these are important people. Think Michael Bloomberg could have made America rich again with his spare change, because if you divide his $500 million in futile campaign spending by 327 million Americans, you get $1 million each. Now, I read that comment, not in John Robson's column, but I read it when it was originally reported. I thought that this has got to be wrong. Bloomberg supposedly spent about $500 million on his failed campaign. There are about 327 million Americans, so if he had spent that on Americans, it would have given each American over $1 million. No. It would have given each American maybe a dollar and a half, actually a little bit less. I thought that this has got to be a mistake. Well, apparently there was no mistake. John Robson continues, I know math is hard, but that infamous clip of Brian Williams of MSNBC and Mara Gay of the New York Times editorial board shows we're in a lot of trouble. Billions of it. Decades ago, C.D. Howe, who was a liberal politician, got roasted because John Diefenbaker pretended he asked insouciantly, well, what's a million? That's $1 million. In a budgetary debate. Well, how much worse would it have been if it was a serious question? For the record, it's a one with six zeros after it. That's $1 million. Also, perhaps more significantly, 1,000 times 1,000. Whereas Williams apparently thought it was 1,000 divided by 1,000 or something. But anyway, I won't belabor the math. Of course, I checked all this math stuff, writes John Robson. It wasn't hard because I have a calculator on my phone. But so does Yang and Williams and Gay. Which is why, when I first saw their clip, I doubted my sanity. How could they be that wrong? Could they? They're elite journalists, also liberals. And Cook calls the episode proof that people whining enviously about billionaires lack the math skills to understand that the rich have not snatched all the potatoes, leaving the rest of us one skinny, cold, overcooked fry. I was glad to see him, John Robson, pick up on this and flail these guys. They're both big noises, which makes it doubly concerning that they have an audience. They're supposed to be important. One's on the editorial board of the New York Times. The other's a commentator for MSNBC. They have a platform. You would think they would at least be able to do the math and would not put out this ridiculous idea that if Bloomberg had spent, given the money to Americans individually, each American could be a millionaire. In fact, if he'd given his $500 million that he spent on his campaign to the American people, all 327 million of them, each American would have gotten slightly over about $1.25. Not $1 million each. Not 10,000 or 100,000 or even 1,000 or even 100. A little over $1. In other words, chicken feed. I'm in the process of a big argument with a Canadian journalist, and I'll tell you about that probably in the next show. But I'm trying to get across to him, that, particularly in reference to something he said about me, that he may not understand just how deep and visceral the anger of many people in the United States and Canada is directed at the lamestream media. And one of the reasons that crowds go crazy with applause every time Donald Trump denounces the fake news media, denounces them as liars, is that people sense from their own experience that we are lied to, or we are misled. And sometimes it isn't exactly an outright lie. It's suppressed information. Like quite often in Canada, we're not told the color of the perpetrators of crime, or the color of the suspects the police are looking for. In fact, quite often we're not told much of anything. The police are looking for the youths in their 20s. And they're right, okay, well, I'll go through my local mall and perhaps, depending on who's hanging around doing nothing, one out of every three or four people could be a youth in their early 20s. And what the press is suppressing is in most cases, they're looking for black youth in their early 20s. Well, that would at least give me something to go on. Well, presumably we want a little more information than just youths in their early 20s, but and who are black. But the mainstream media repeatedly suppresses material. So when you see these self-important people unable to do the simplest of math, I mean, this is not advanced algebra or complicated calculus. This is grade school level arithmetic, or used to be. And even if math is not their forte, as he pointed out, everybody's got a calculator on their phone, or can have a calculator in their office. Before you start running your mouth, you would think they might check those calculators and say, well, okay, have I got it right about the this idea that if Bloomberg had spent his $500 million given to Americans, the American people, each American could have had $1 million. The quickest of calculations would have revealed, no, that... that would not be the case. They might have had just a little bit over a dollar and a bit. Turkey continues to resist the pressure to keep its deal by close its borders to these over 3 million so-called refugees that are in Turkey. Right now, they're allowing these refugees to storm the Greek border, and the Greeks are having to thrust them back. This is what the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, said. We are not thinking of closing these gates. Our proposal to Greece is to open the gates. These people won't stay in Greece. Let them cross from Greece into other European countries, he said, calling for a just, humane sharing of the burden. So he's saying to Greece, oh, don't worry, just let them in, because they don't want to stay in Greece, at least most of them don't. They want to go to better hunting grounds in places like Sweden and Germany, where the welfare is better. Yeah, but really what you're talking about is the invasion of Europe. Whether they stay in Greece or go to Germany or go elsewhere, it's the invasion of Europe. These are almost all Muslims. It's a Muslim problem, a problem that Turkey should take care of, along with the rich Gulf states and Saudi Arabia. Greek military vehicles and soldiers on foot continue to patrol along the iron fence that separates the Kastanias crossing from Turkey's border post at Pasar Kul. Greek officials said the 52 illegals arrested from Monday to Tuesday included Syrians, Afghans, and Iranians. Ankaras, and they're mostly men, too. And you wonder, this is always a very worrisome aspect of so-called refugee politics. Why is it that we're getting so many able-bodied young men in their late teens and 20s and 30s? Usually, in a refugee situation, you send the women and children, the old folks ahead. Well, because this is a quasi-military invasion. These people are coming to take over. Ankara says Greece's stance violates the migrants' rights. It has also accused Greek forces of shooting dead four illegals on the border, a claim that Athens disputes. Violates their rights. They don't have any rights. They're invaders. They're illegals. They don't have any rights. At least they don't have any rights to be in the European Union or to be in Greece. I found that interesting. Now, I'm no fan of Woody Allen. So I think some of his movies were quite brilliant. Anyway, according to Barbara Kay of the National Post, Woody Allen is the latest victim of cancel culture. And it seems that he has written a book. And it's to be published by Hachette Book Group. It's about his life. Well, he comes from a very dysfunctional family. Ronan Farrow is Alan's estranged adoptive son. And he's written a Me Too-themed book called Catch and Kill. Ronan Farrow is the most vigorous ally of his sister Dylan in her long-standing charge of sexual abuse by Alan in 1992 when she was 7 years old. Now, whether or not that happened, we don't know. Anyway, the big publishing firm Hachette Book Group, or HBG, was going to publish Woody Allen's autobiography. Anyway, there was a protest by workers, actually a strike by workers at HBG, and they've decided to pull the book. In other words, the management has allowed HBG to, some dissident workers to tell them whom to publish. Last May, Barbara Kay writes, I wrote about Hesh Keston. He's the author of The Siege of Tel Aviv, which endured a similar experience to Allen's. His publisher, Zhank Books, bowed to the Twitter mob and a protest on the part of its staff and authors over the demonstrably non-existent Islamophobia in Keston's novel. It was a novel. And withdrew the book from circulation. From the most damning comments on social media, it was not clear that their authors had even read the book. At the time, Keston remarked that Zhank Publishers did what they were expected to do in society today. They abandoned the norms that we old guys used to believe that were sacrosanct, that you can have unpopular opinions. And this is very much what this is all about. This is what Barbara Kay, she ends her article with. Here's what HBG should have done. First, publicly wished Ronan Farrow a polite but firm farewell. He actually worked for the firm for HBG. He's the strange son of Woody Allen, adoptive son. So they should have fired him. Then sought out the protest ringleaders among its staff and summarily fired them. Finally, send all employees a memo notifying them that institutional loyalty and deference to executive decisions are standpoints of HBG culture. Staffers who chose not to resign should have been expected to respect these principles in the future or face consequences. Plum jobs in publishing are not a dime a dozen. These strategies would have worked like a charm. Somebody has to stand athwart publishing cancel culture and yell stop. It should have been HBG, which is a big publisher, and I agree with her on that. These dissident employees, if they're going to try to sabotage the company, should have been fired. But we live in an era where cancel culture often reigns supreme, and with catastrophic consequences. And I don't have a dog in this race. I'm not overly exercised about whether Woody Allen ever has his autobiography published. Because he can always self-publish, and he's certainly wealthy enough to do that. Well, this is Paul Fromm. I'm going to take my musical break right now, and I'm going to play a song by George Jones. George was a great singer and supporter of traditional country music, and this is called Who's Going to Fill Their Shoes?
Carrying there, pal?
George Jones.
You mean the band? George must fly everywhere.
Nope. Just George's trip. We're heading home.
We don't see nobody since the interstate opened. Do you think he might sign my guitar?
He's awake in there. Holler at him.
Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones?
Yeah. Hey, old hammer. What do you know?
Would you sign my guitar?
A few others have. I sure would.
Great. Just a second.
Oh, my goodness. Would you look at this? Waylon, Hay, Lefty, Willie. Where in the world did you get this?
They were all right here. This used to be the main highway. We just got lucky a few years, I guess.
Well, my goodness. What else you got?
Come on in.
All right.
You know, this old world is full of singers, but just a few are chosen to tear your heart out when they sing. Imagine life without it. All your radio heroes, like the outlaw that walks through Jesse's dream. No, there'll never be another red-headed stranger, a man in black and Folsom prison blue. The Okie from Muskogee, or hello, darling. Lord, I wonder who's gonna fill their shoes.
Who's gonna fill their shoes? Who's gonna stand that tall?
Who's gonna play the Opry and the Wabash Cannonball? Who's gonna give their heart and soul to get to me and you? Lord, I wonder
who's gonna fill their shoes?
God bless the boys from Memphis. Blue suede shoes and Elvis. Much too soon he left this world in tears. They tore up the 50s. Old Jerry Lee and Charlie. And Go Cat Go still echoes through the years. You know the heart of country music still beats in Luke the Drifter. You can tell it when he sang I Saw the Light. Old Marty, Hank and Lefty, why I can feel him right here with me on this silver eagle rolling through the night.
Who's gonna fill their shoes? Who's gonna stand that tall?
Who's gonna play the opera and the
Wabash Cannonball?
Who's gonna give their heart and soul to get to me and you? Lord, I wonder
who's gonna fill their shoes?
Yes, I wonder who's gonna fill.
Hey, George, what happened back there?
I don't think you'd believe it, brother. I just don't think you would.
That was George Jones. Here's a medley of songs, mostly Hank Williams songs.
I'm going to do you a little medley of Hank Williams songs. If you hear one
by
you like,
Boxcar Willie.
I tried so hard, my dear, to show that you're my every dream. If you're afraid each thing I do is just some evil scheme. The more I learn to care for you, the more we drift apart. Why can't I free your doubtful mind and melt your cold, cold heart? Yeah. Take these chains from my heart and set me free. Be as fair to my heart as you can be. You do. I know that I could never be this blue. If you only loved me half as much as I love you. Today I passed you on the street. I can't help it if I'm still in love with you. Somebody else stood by your side and he looked so satisfied. I can't help it if I'm still in love with you. Everybody knows this. Your cheating heart will let you
They spoke. If somebody didn't know this next song of Hank Williams, here's the song that made his name famous all around our world. I got a feeling cold and blue, blue, Lord, since my baby said goodbye. God, I don't know how to do. All I do is sit inside. Songs unless we did the first one that he ever put on record. Do y'all know what the first song he ever put out was? Goes like this. Came in last night at half past 10, baby of mine, she wouldn't let me in, so moving on.
That was Boxcar Willie, and hope you like it. I just a great entertainer, and gonna conclude here with a song by
this next young fellow we have coming out here. May not be so beautiful.
Grandpa Jones.
Come to think of it, he may not be so young either, but he's a great entertainer, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy him just a whole lot. So, how about a great big rousing welcome for Grandpa Jones?
Thank you very much. You know, Ernie, to look at him, you wouldn't think he is one of the finest English students in the country, but I used to live down where he is at, and his teacher was so proud of him that every time that somebody would come in to to visit the school, why they'd get his class up in front of the little school and start asking them questions. Well, I went over there one day and I sat down in the back of the school there, and of course the teacher got his class up right away and started asking them English questions. Come to Ernest, said, "Ernest, get up there and tell us the difference between prose and poetry." Well, Ernest didn't know, and it sort of embarrassed the teacher, and she says, "Well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll write some on the board. I'll write some prose, and then I'll write some poetry." So she wrote, "There was an old woman who lived on a hill, and last week she moved to town." She says, "That's prose, because it doesn't rhyme." Then she wrote, "There was an old woman lived on a hill, and if she's not dead, she's a-living there still." She says, "That's poetry, because it does rhyme." Ernest says, "I understand that all right." So the next morning she thought she'd catch him on it. She says, "Ernest, get up there and tell us the difference between prose and poetry this morning." Ernest jumped up and he said, "There was an old woman that lived by the well, and when she died, she went to what do you want, prose or poetry?"
This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me here on AltRightTV.com. Going to sign off tonight, as I always do, with the anthem of the real Canada, "The Maple Leaf Forever." This is Paul Fromm, and you're on the fighting side of me.